Don't get crushed by debt. California Community College's career education has more than 200 different career programs, so you can get the quality, hands-on training you need for the career you want. Learn more about career education programs in your community at californiacareereducation.com.
Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Wren Women Salon Podcast, a series of interviews about what it is to be a modern-day Renaissance woman and how to flourish as a Wren woman in today's world. I'm your host, Dale Griffith Stamos, co-author of Wren Women, What Modern Renaissance Women Have to Teach Us About Living Rich, Fulfilling Lives. Welcome to our Meet the Wren Women podcast, a series featuring incredible modern-day Renaissance women who are profiled in our book, Wren Women. This series, along with our Wren Women Among Us series, which features Renaissance-style women I have been meeting since the publication of the book, will introduce you to some extraordinary women. People often ask, what is a Wren woman? And the short answer is, a Wren woman is someone, past or present, who is a multifaceted Renaissance-style woman who brings to the world a unique perspective and expansive attitude. She is not only about achievement, but about service and about embracing a meaningful life. Today, I am very pleased to welcome Dale and Alexandra Friends into the program. Dale and Alex are incredible mother-daughter Wren women who both appeared in our book, Wren Women. Dale started her career as a classically trained soprano in musical theater, operetta, and opera, working with icons like Placido Domingo, Frederica von Stade, and Sir Peter Hall, just to name a few. After 20 years, Dale's career took a surprising and wonderful turn as she was asked to create a performing arts center in Santa Monica, California. Dale raised over $123 million to build and run the Broad Stage and served as its founding director for 17 years and founding artistic director for seven seasons. After stepping down, Dale embarked on another new path and is now developing and producing a new musical called Hadestown, which in its off-Broadway run was praised by reviewers as luminous and spellbinding. She is also a public speaking lecturer and strategic mentor to nonprofits and artists and has worked with hundreds of performers, nonprofits, and artists. Her work includes classes, retreats, consulting, and one-on-ones. Alexandra has a thriving online business in which she expresses her many skills as entrepreneur, writer, and overall inspirer. When, as a young woman, she was looking for her path, she tried many things, including getting both a helicopter and a massage license. She then landed a job at a public radio station where she worked as a writer, producer, and in the technology department. But something inside her was calling out to pursue a different kind of work, and she set herself a target date to leave, after which she tapped into her writing skills to pursue various writing projects, including ghostwriting. Soon, she developed the online business she now runs, and it is a business in perfect alignment with her many skills. She writes about creativity, productivity, goal setting, handling adversity, disappointment, and fear, and how we can all use our gifts to create a positive ripple in the world. She also holds classes and writing, fitness, and yoga retreats, and is a nonfiction and fiction book author, as well as a multiply published article writer for magazines such as Forbes, Time, Newsweek, and The Huffington Post. Her just-released book, You're Going to Survive, is full of inspiring stories from people from all walks of life, including authors, chefs, lawyers, website designers, Broadway performers, and more. Each of them describes one of the worst moments in their entire career and how they got through it. It is available on Amazon. Both Dale and Alex represent the Wren women traits of risk-taking, expansive growth, curiosity, creative problem solving, flexibility, and a trust in one's inner voice. Hello, Dale. Hello, Alex.
Hello.
I'm so glad to have you both here. It's great. It's a reunion of sorts, since we, of course, have all talked and met since with the development of the book, Ren Women. And what's fun mm-hmm. for me is to see how much more you have both done in the few years since I first interviewed you. You've been very, very busy.
Yes, indeed.
Indeed. So let's start out with just talking about, let's start with you, Dale. So obviously in typical Ren Women fashion, you have both pursued multiple passions and careers. So Dale, tell us about your various careers and how you got into each of them.
Well, I started out as a classical musician, which at a very young age, actually, my father was a classical opera buff. My mother was a classical flautist. She didn't work professionally, but there was always lots of music in the house. My grandmother was one of the early founders of work with young children in rhythm, you know, even before the Kodály method that became taught all through Manhattan. And so I was raised in that kind of environment. And by the time I was 16, I was singing gigs. I had done television. I had performed in all the musicals at my high school. And I knew that I wanted to continue either in music theater or into classical music, which is what I did really until my early 40s. And I was just very lucky. I had a light lyric soprano voice. My first teacher was Marnie Nixon, who had a very similar voice. She was the voice of Natalie Wood in West Side Story and Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. But she was also a phenomenal live performance teacher, and she worked in Los Angeles. So after having that career, which is really what that's all I ever thought I would do, would be a classical singer and perform, and I loved it. I sang music theater, operetta, opera, recitals, television, radio. I did everything. And at the same time, was lucky enough to be able to be married and have my children, which was very unusual at the time for somebody in that profession. And then in my early 40s, I started to feel like there was something else I should be doing. I was feeling that I just wanted to grow more and have more control over my time and my life and sort of be more the captain of my own ship rather than somebody who worked on the ship. Which is, you know, when you're an opera singer, you're part of a team. And even if you're Plácido Domingo, you have to be tied to a rehearsal schedule and what the director wants. And I was starting to feel what I think a lot of women in their early 40s feel, which is that they want to become more powerful and stand up more in a different way, which also coincided with the birth of my last child, Olivia. So lo and behold, I started putting out feelers, and I wasn't really sure exactly what I wanted to do, except I knew I wanted to stay in the arts. And 18 months later, I was starting on the course that would keep me busy the next 17 years, which was building a small visual and performing arts center, which became the Broad Stage in Santa Monica, California. And although I think my journey in that way was unusual, I did find other people who had made that same journey, including Beverly Silk, the great American soprano, who then went on to run New York City Opera, and go on the board of the Met, and had a very similar career transition to what I did. So she was a great role model for me, both as a young singer and then as an artistic director and director of an institution. Then the same thing happened again about 3 years ago. I finished my child-rearing years. My kids are grown up and launched. And I had been running the Broad Stage and working pretty much 24/7 for many, many years. And I kind of reached a point of feeling like this is either it for the rest of my life or there's something else. And sure enough, there was something else. And what happened is I had started developing a musical called Hadestown, and I decided to step down from the Broad Stage. And a week later, Hadestown got picked up by a New York off-Broadway theater company, and I found myself suddenly in a whole new world as a commercial producer. which is the world I'm in now. So that's kind of a long-winded answer.
Yes, but that's it. You have, I mean, in a way, you need to go through all of that to tell us about these transitions. And since then, also, you seem to be, consulting and mentoring people as well. How did that come about?
Well, I think the biggest difference for me, and it's funny because I've been thinking a lot about women my age. I'm in my 60s now, and I don't want to work 24/7 the way I had worked my entire life between juggling and working and being married. They're literally never having a free moment to sit and sip a cup of tea, always on the
right.
run. I don't want to work that way anymore. So part of what I'm doing in my life now isn't 24/7. I'm producing a show, but I have three partners. The show is actually, most of the work is based in New York. Right now I'm actually in snowy Edmonton. Everybody up here is saying Merry Christmas because I'm looking outside and it's like tons of snow. They're calling it a white Halloween. Uh-huh. It's actually really funny.
Oh,
everybody at the airport last night was complaining about the snow, and I told them I was all excited because I got to wear my parka that I bought a year ago. So I'm up here, and my work now is mostly not in Los Angeles because the show is actually going to be going to Broadway in the fall of 2018. So it's a very different lifestyle for me. I started doing a little bit of work with Allie, which has been a blast, helping her when she does her retreats. We did a couple of retreats last year, which was so much fun, mostly just to hang out with Allie and see what she's up to. Then we actually just finished doing a class called Out Loud, which also was sort of an excuse just to hang out together again in Portland, New York, and LA. And I started mentoring, which is something I can do on my own time, some artists in Los Angeles, and also doing some lessons on Skype, on public speaking. But mostly I have a very different lifestyle now, and I'm actually exploring how I want that to keep evolving because it's new for me. Mm-hmm. Having never taken a show to Broadway, I know that, you know, the 4 to 6 months before we go, I'll probably have to move to New York and it will be very intense. So I'm very loath to commit to anything full steam right at this moment.
Yeah. 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 And what I love is the exploration process that I think that a lot of folks get stuck in one thing and they get stuck in one lifestyle and don't realize that within their power, with a little bit of creativity and broader thinking, they can, in fact, create a lifestyle that is suited to whatever phase of life that they feel themselves to be in at the time. So that's wonderful. Now, Alex, tell us about the various careers you have pursued as well.
Whoa, I feel like, Mom, I really loved, by the way, hearing more of your story. I didn't know that about your grandma, how she was involved in the arts as well. So thank you for sharing. I'm learning about you on this podcast. So my career journey is in some ways similar to my mom in that I think both of us are very concerned with how our life feels, as well as concerned with making a difference in the world and creating art and, you know, creating a positive ripple effect. My story is a bit different in that, unlike my mom, who from a very early age, you know, had this obvious and evident gift as a singer, I felt a bit more scattered when I was younger. I had a lot of different abilities and skills. I was sort of the kid in high school who didn't really have just one thing that I obviously shined at. I was like sort of good at a lot of different things, which is a great thing, but also left me feeling a bit lost, to be honest. I looked at, you know, people like my mom who had this amazing gift and talent as a singer, and people like my brother who has this amazing gift and talent as a musician, and even people like my dad who's, you know, worked in the same industry his entire life. And I sort of found myself wondering, especially as a teenager, like, where do I fit in? You know, what's my special thing? And it really took me a while to figure that out. And as you mentioned in the intro that you read about me, my early 20s were really all over the place. I was in college, then I dropped out, then I went back. I switched my major in college about 18 different times. At one point I was, you know, into physiology and kinesiology. At another point I was doing religious studies. At another point I did English literature. I was really all over the place. I did many strange, odd jobs throughout those years, some of which I am embarrassed to even name aloud. And I also pursued, you know, different kind of certifications. I actually saved up money and put myself through helicopter pilot school, which is something that to this day sort of feels like a bizarre dream. I can't believe it really happened, but it did. And
it really
I got licensed. My mom saw me fly around Long Beach Airport.
I almost had a heart attack. I saw literally get in the helicopter. It was like one of those moments where I thought, oh my God. But she did it.
Yeah. But I did it. And I, you know, at the time I was, you know, pretty seriously considering, you know, maybe this is it for me. Maybe this is my thing. Maybe I'm supposed to work in the aviation industry and become a cool female pilot. At another point, I studied massage therapy. So I did a variety of different things. Ultimately, though, the common thread that I kept coming back to throughout my early 20s was I love writing. I love storytelling. I've always been interested in media, whether that's, you know, blogging or the publishing industry or the radio industry. That's just always been like kind of this magnet that I just am drawn to over and over. And so in my early 20s, around, I guess, age 22 or so, I was about a year out of college, I guess, or maybe had just graduated. I don't remember the exact timeline, but I wound up getting myself an internship at a large public broadcasting company based in the Midwest. And interestingly, they told me later, because it was a very competitive internship, they had tons of applications, they told me that it was because that I put on my resume that I was a helicopter pilot that they wanted to meet me and called me in. So in a roundabout way, that strange choice led to kind of my first big break in the media industry, I guess you could say. And I ended up working for that public radio company for several years. And much like my mom's, you know, journey, it was a great thing in many ways. It sort of launched me. There came a point where I realized, and I was much younger than my mom when I realized this, that I wanted to be the captain of my own ship to some extent. And I wanted more control over my own schedule. I didn't want to work crazy hours in a cubicle. I wanted more freedom, both in terms of my time, but also creative freedom. You know, I wanted to work on my own projects and not have to go through, you know, 17 layers of managerial approval to move something forward. I wanted to just have my own platform. So I started taking the tiny baby steps to move in that direction, which ultimately ended with me quitting that job and walking away and starting my own business, which I've now run for the last 8 years.
Wonderful. And you know, it's really interesting because both of your stories reflect a different way of being a Renaissance woman. And what I've noticed is that there are kind of two styles, one of which I call sequential, and the other one I call simultaneous. And so the sequential Ren women are the women who very much like Dale, like you did, they are thoroughly and utterly, you know, committed to one thing at one time, but as they grow and evolve, they explore and develop new skills and move into different careers and then again, once again, do that and then once again, do that. And that's a sort of sequential Ren woman. A simultaneous one is much more like you, Alex. They, and I'm in that category, so I totally relate. And they are the ones who have this plethora of skills and desires and passions and things they enjoy doing. And very often the simultaneous Ren woman will feel, you know, unfocused or scattered for a while, you know, until they begin to understand that the skills actually can work together and enhance each other. You know, you said something wonderful that I quoted in the book, Alex, and that is, you said a lot of Renaissance souls are looking for an overarching mission. Speak a little bit to that, because I think the people who feel somewhat scattered they need to hear that particular message.
Yeah, you know, something that I've come to realize over the last couple of years of my life is that, and this is just my personal opinion, but I don't really believe that we're born with a purpose in the sense that, you know, you're born and you're sort of stamped with this greater purpose and that's what it is and it never changes. I don't think that our purpose is something that is predetermined. I think your life purpose is something that you choose. It's a choice, just like anything else. It's like you choose, you know, where you live or what outfit you put on. You choose your purpose. And so something that has really helped me over the years to feel less scattered and to feel more focused is just reminding myself my purpose is up to me. So, for example, and I also think that your purpose might change as you go through the seasons of your life. Right now, I work as a writer. I'm an author. I do writing coaching and consulting and editing and all kinds of writing-related things. And really, my purpose is to help people to complete creative projects. I want to help people launch their book, launch their podcast, you know, get their art out into the world. That is my driving purpose. But it's a purpose I've chosen, which gives me a feeling of empowerment. And I also know that 5 to 10 years from now, I may choose another purpose and work on that for 5 to 10 years. So, yeah, that's the shift from, oh, my God, what is my purpose? What is my purpose? Searching for my purpose to I choose my purpose for me has been very empowering and has given me a lot of focus.
You know, and listening to Allie, it made me think, you know, we live in a time where the average woman will probably in Western society will probably live somewhere between 75 and 90 years old. And that's an average now.
Yes.
And they're saying that the average person will have 3 to 5 careers throughout their life. So when you think about these are not things that our parents or grandparents had to think about. They had one career because they probably died shortly after that, and after they retired. And I think that opens a tremendous amount of possibilities, but it also begins to coincide with different parts of your development as a human being. I mean, I did start off with a single purpose, and my son very much has a single purpose. But as I got older, that purpose, I would say, broadened and allowed other things to come in. And part of that was because of my age. I think there are very few people who are performing at 78 years old. I mean, Plácido Domingo is one of them. But even Plácido conducts, runs a company, is involved in philanthropic work. You know, I mean, so even he has broadened from just being a classical musician to encompass other aspects of what happens to us as we age. I think right now, one of the things I'm interested in is as women get older, the way that they want to work can also change. For those of us who grew up during the feminist first wave or second wave and were the ones that wanted it all, which, by the way, many young people don't want it all now. That's a very valid choice that they're making. But for those of us who did want it all, to be suddenly in your 60s and not be raising children and not juggling career and marriage and everything at the same time is an incredible, it's almost like a vacation. Feels like a strange, you know what I mean? It feels like a strange planet. I've been talking to so many women my age who we did all of those things and now actually have time to sit down and play our ukulele or read poetry or volunteer in ways that we want to volunteer, but also to think about being in the world in a different way. So even though my way of being in the world has always been very single focused, you could say, or you said sequential, I actually am feeling right now that I'm making a shift that I may not be that way, that I may start to feel differently. Something that's come up for me, and part of it is what's going on in the world right now, is being more politically involved. It's not something that I have been deeply in the past because I was very involved in arts education and children's rights and things like that. But now I'm actually feeling I need to do something right now in terms of what is going on in our country and what is going on in the world. And that may shift what I do. I may not stay in the arts in the same way. And then in conclusion, when Allie went to get her helicopter license, I never questioned if that was a good idea because I understand both in her and in myself and in others that sometimes doing something that you accomplish that is very different and remarkable actually opens up your brain to see the world in a different way. And as an artist, that's something that I've had to strive with many times. When you get stuck in a role, or when you get stuck because you can't figure out how to sing something, you have to flip it on its head. So I actually think her accomplishing at a very young age something that seemed very impossible was unbelievably empowering for her, and let her know that she could pretty much accomplish anything she wanted to. Because honestly, to be the youngest kid to get a helicopter degree at 21 years old was a huge accomplishment that in many ways changed the course of her life. And I think that's true for her. Don't you think, Allie?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and my motivations for signing up to do a helicopter pilot program when I was 19 or 20 or whatever I was, pretty young, was I wanted to feel powerful, and I wanted to feel more confident, and I wanted to achieve something that was totally outside of my comfort zone. And it was. I mean, I was truly, like, literally terrified almost every single day that I walked into that airport to go to my classes. I was trembling. My heart was pounding. I was determined to do well and study hard and be an excellent pilot, but it was wildly outside of my comfort zone. And I'll never forget how it felt to do my, you know, you basically pass an exam, just like getting a driver's license when I did, it's called my check ride, with the evaluator, and he told me that I was one of the best young female pilots he'd ever met. That was like the greatest validation of my life. And I realized, exactly like my mom said, like, oh my God, if I can do this, I can do anything. I can finish my college degree that I walked away from. I can get a job at a dream company. Maybe I can start my own business one day. Like, that's easy compared to this. So it was a huge, huge kind of coin in my confidence bank. And even though I ultimately walked away from that industry completely and never pursued it as a career, it absolutely opened doors for me, sometimes in literal ways, like I mentioned, you know, getting called in for a job interview because it was on my resume. But more than that, it was the way it made me feel that was so important at that early stage in my life.
You know, and that's it. That, you know, and that leads really naturally into this question, which is that one of the Wren women traits is risk taking, is, you know, being willing to take those risks. And so you just described a big risk. You know, you were terrified, and yet you did it. And in the doing, you know, you found resources within yourself that you probably didn't know existed. And so talk to me, both Dale and Alex, about risks. Let's start with Dale, about risks that you have taken and what kind of fear was involved and what kind of excitement was involved.
Wow. I don't know. People ask me this question all the time, like, who do you think you were to build a performing arts center? You didn't know anything about it, and you'd never raised money. And the funniest thing is, honestly, it never occurred to me that I couldn't do it. I just thought, how hard can this be? You know, I was making my living as an opera singer, where if I didn't have a high C, I'd be out of work. That seemed a lot harder than going out and trying to build some. I don't know. I think I'm one of those people who, certainly in my younger time, I wouldn't say I'm fearless, but I would say my attitude is always been, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is I fail. And that's not so bad. You know, it's like if I fail to build a performing arts center, then I'm one of 99% in the world who fail. It's not the end of the world, and I'll learn that I can't do it. But it never, I don't know, I think I was raised by certainly my father, who was a huge risk taker and probably the greatest and deepest influence on my life in terms of this. I think my attitude is, you know, I'm someone who lives in a first world country. I'm unbelievably privileged. I live in the great blue state of California. What's the worst that can happen? It's not like I'm starving or diseased or without a home or abused. I feel like if I can't take a risk, you know, who can? I think it's much more remarkable when I meet young people who are taking risks who have had no infrastructure, who come from no security. I mean, I came from a very privileged, secure, artistic family that encouraged me to be creative. I work with people and young women who don't come from that, who have had no hand up, you know, in life or leg up. So for me, in some ways, I feel like I don't get to be fearful. You know, I mean, there have been times when I had to do auditions for things. Well, yes, I was scared, but I also felt like, okay, you're scared, but do it anyway. And I've just been very lucky like that. I've always had a great support system. I mean, my husband has been unbelievable in that way. And I do feel, in talking to young people, I just say to them, look, what's the worst case? You know, the worst thing that can happen is it doesn't work out, and then you go on to the next thing. And you learn, you learn from your failure. I mean, all of us have had failures. Everybody has tried something that didn't work out. But you learn from it. You know, if you decide to go and study something and you discover, you know what? I mean, I was just talking to a woman, a wonderful woman, who started a global company called Inspiring Women. And she's a Spanish lawyer. But she actually wanted to be a doctor. And she started off going to medical school. And on the second day, realized that she couldn't stand the sight of blood. So she dropped out. And this is, you know, and this was her dream for years. But I mean, I think, so that's, and she said she doesn't believe in life plan. She believes that you take opportunities and you create opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I would say I agree with that, too. Allie's a good
very,
example
very
of that.
Very much what Allie said.
But I think it's true. I think you push through. If you do have fear, you just push through it. Because what's the worst that can happen? Admit you're fearful. Everybody's fearful. Everybody has nerves and anxiety at certain times. You just welcome everybody into that and move on.
I love this attitude. And certainly embracing and learning from failure is another of the Ren Women traits that I talk about in the book. Dale, I'm going to ask you something, and that is we've been getting a lot of clicking sounds from your audio, and I'm wondering if you might want to switch away from the earphones and try just speaking through your phone and see if we can maybe resolve
that. Okay, we'll do that.
Are you hearing it too, Alex?
No, I'm just speaking through my phone.
I don't hear the clicking.
Let's try
personally.
That. Yeah, I can hear you. It may just be coming through, you know, the podcast, but it is something that I wanted to see if we could mitigate a little bit. So, yeah, let's try this for a while, Dale, and see how that works. So Alex, you know, I think, Alex, you have... I get this feeling that Dale came in out of the womb as an extrovert. You did not, and nor did I. And so, I had to get over fear in many phases of my life. How did fear and the issue of risk taking play out in your life, Alex?
Well, yes, I definitely am not an extrovert. I am, I would say, an extreme introvert. I remember being a little kid at elementary school and at lunchtime and recess when all the kids would run out to the playground to, you know, play tetherball or soccer or whatever, I would make a beeline for the library and read books with the librarian, Barbara Metzenbaum, who was my best friend, and basically just, you know, kind of lose myself in that world. And I have never been an extrovert, but I do believe that both extroverts and introverts have great power in their own way. As that relates to risk-taking, you know, I think that much like my mom, I feel a tremendous sense of privilege. You know, I was raised in California, in a liberal state, in a prosperous family with amazing, loving parents. It's sort of like, on some level, I feel like, you know, it would be shameful for me not to be brave and take risks in a way. I feel like I've been given every possible advantage. So of course I need to do something great with my life and to support others as well. But that being said, you know, regardless of your economic situation or your upbringing, we all feel fear at times. You know, I'm sure even people at the highest level, Hillary Clinton, Michelle Obama, people that we admire, I'm sure they feel fear. In fact, you know, we know they do because they share stories about this. So no matter who you are or what stage of life you're at or even how much wealth you have, you know, fear is something that we all deal with. It's part of the human experience whenever we're taking a big, big risk. Much like my mom, though, and I bet this is something that I kind of absorbed from her growing up,
I definitely have the mindset of what's the worst that could happen, right? And I think that's such a powerful question. One exercise that I do with myself from time to time, I call it the worst case scenario exercise or the plan Z. So meaning, you know, when we think about what we want out of life, we have sort of a plan A, and then we have like a plan B, sort of like, okay, well, not as great, like a fallback plan. But what's your plan Z? Meaning, if everything you're trying to achieve just wildly falls apart, you know, you're bankrupt, you're alone, you're starving, you have no home, you've lost everything, your friends hate you. Like, if you imagine the absolute worst case scenario and write it down, like in vivid detail, what it would be like. For me, my worst case scenario, my plan Z is my business is in shambles, my partner has left me, I work at a dive bar where I sing, you know, Dolly Parton songs, karaoke style, and I sling beer to bikers, and I share a one-bedroom apartment.
With me, I'm with you on the ukulele.
Right, mom's on with the ukulele. For some reason, I've become like a chain smoker, and I live in a studio apartment that I share with three like hulking men who are named, you know, Big Joe Daddy and whatever. Like, and if you really, if you paint a vivid picture of what your worst case scenario would be, at least when I do that, first of all, it becomes almost funny, right? Because you realize, okay, that's probably never going to happen. But even if it did happen, I know I could survive that. You know, I've lived in not great apartments before. I've had no money before. You know, being broke and being alone is not a death sentence. You know, it's a bummer, and it's certainly not what I want to create for myself. But even if the worst were to happen, I know I could survive it. And once you have that realization, I think it's very liberating, and it gives you more confidence to take risks because you know no matter what happens, no matter how bad it gets, I do believe I can survive and I can take care of myself at the end of the day. So that's something that I recommend people try is rather than feeling sort of an ambiguous fog of fear about the future, really get specific. What's your best case scenario? What's your second case scenario? And what's your worst case scenario? And could you survive in any of those scenarios? And the answer is probably yes.
It's a wonderful, that's a wonderful suggestion. You know, Dale, you had mentioned your father, and your father was a very interesting man who also played a big role in your life and whom you also lost at a young age. Talk a little bit about your dad.
My dad was an extrovert. He was a larger-than-life personality in ways that when I was young, you know, embarrassed me horrendously. But looking back on it now, I just think it was so hysterical. I mean, he used to do things to discourage boyfriends, like he'd show up at the door in his underwear doing pirouettes, hoping that if there was a boyfriend at the door, the boyfriend would go away. I mean, he was just a total nutcase. But he had a very big life and made some hugely different choices. He was one of the youngest people to graduate from Harvard Law School. I think he graduated high school at 14 or 15. He then became a lawyer. He then went into the Army and worked as a data encryptor in World War II. He then worked in the Nuremberg trials as a prosecutor, liberating the camps and deposing Albert Speer, among others. And when he came back to America at 27 years old or 28 after having gone through this, he realized that there was never going to be another law case that would be as as exciting and challenging as the Nuremberg trials. Yeah. So he changed professions and went into exhibition and distribution in for Famous Players, which then led him to become he was from New York. He then moved to California and became the general manager of ABC, launched his own television producing network, and also became one of the first television producers to produce films, ended up producing films like Charlie, which won the Academy Award for Cliff Robinson. So he was somebody who made a lot of different choices, was pretty fearless. And like a lot of people who came back from the war, I think they came back with this feeling of you better live life to the hilt. because life is very fragile. And I remember him saying to me that he felt what we had to live under with the nuclear war was far greater than what he had grown up under, which ironically, looking back on that now, I think of what my children have to live under, and maybe every parent feels it gets worse, or maybe it is getting worse. It's hard to decide. But he was a huge influence, and I think that the message was, you know, life is short, life is precious. Don't assume you'll be here forever. And I know Allie has that. I'm for better or for worse, I think I've given that to my children, that this is precious time. Don't waste it. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be here forever. And I always felt that, having lost a parent at a very young age, I didn't think I would live to this age. And I think everybody who loses a parent young, when you get to the age of your parent, when that parent died, you have this feeling of, is my time coming too? And it does create a sense of urgency in how you live your life. I'm happy to say I don't feel that way anymore, having lived past my father by 15 years at this point. I feel like I can relax because no matter what happens now, it's okay, whatever happens now. But he does. He did influence me tremendously, and he continues to, because he loved life. He never missed a sunset. He had this great love of music. He was a great natural musician and could have become a professional if he wanted to. He gave me this sense of how precious and how wonderful this time is.
And it sounds like he was absolutely a Renaissance-style man.
He was in his own way. I mean, I think for men, let's face it, I don't think that men were allowed to be Renaissance men in the 50s and 60s. You were supposed to be a breadwinner. He was raised under certain beliefs also, but he was a Renaissance man in the sense that he had many interests.
Yes, exactly. And it does sound like, to some extent, like yourself, he went sequentially through different careers, and that was one way that he was able to express that.
That's true.
I know that, and I think you and I talked about, Dale, the influence of our fathers on us. And in my own life, my father was a very deep influence. And I think if you were raised in the 50s and 60s, that, you know, the mothers, unfortunately, were often, you know, didn't have as many choices as we did. And therefore, often it was our fathers who sort of showed us the world of possibilities, and certainly that was the case with my father. You also said something, Dale, that I often quote to other women, and sometimes on the podcast with these new Ren women I've been meeting, and that is when you said, choose your spouse wisely. I chose mine extremely wisely, and it can make a world of difference. So talk to me about your husband and how he has aided and abetted your development. And also, Alex, talk about the person who is currently probably for a long time in your life, and how they are in terms of a support system to you. So, Dale, let's start with you.
Well, I mean, I guess I would say, you know, the person that you decide, if you decide to be in a partnership that you're going to be with, you're going to spend the most time with. So it better be somebody who really has your back, and that it really is a partnership. I've been very lucky. I married somebody who wants the best for me, and in me getting the best for me, he feels that he gets the best. But I have to feel the same way also. And we do. He's been a partner. We're very much partners, not just in the home and the family, but in our work. I definitely feel, and many women I've talked to, when you don't have a supportive spouse, it's a nightmare. It makes it so difficult. It's like a noose around your neck. Everything is heavy lifting. But when you have a supportive spouse who has your back, who picks you up when you're down, who encourages you to go forward and become your greatest self, it's just such a blessing. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I don't think I could have accomplished what I've done without him. Honestly, I'm absolutely sure that without Don, I would never have achieved everything that I've achieved and stayed sane, you know, and stayed balanced, reasonably balanced and sane. At the same time, I think the challenge for all of us now is that the definitions of male and female partnerships are greatly changing, and how that changes works both ways. There are, I just said this to Ali recently, you can have everything, but maybe not all at the same time. And I think that's true. There are times when my work took precedent. There are times when his needs take precedence, and you both have to be okay with that. I don't know if everybody is okay with that. There, I know many young women who choose to live alone, and young men, rather than have to give up any of their priorities for themselves. That was not the case for me. I've gotten to do what I wanted to do, but it's an ebb and flow. And I think that the great beauty of being in a partnership is that it should be a wonderful addition to your life and a core center to your life. But if it isn't that, there's no reason to be in a partnership.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And Alex, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with everything my mom just said. And I've been so blessed to watch my mom and my dad enjoy a, now 34-year partnership together, which is incredible. I'm currently with a guy named Brandon. We have our 4-year anniversary coming up in just a few days, actually. And I totally agree. Yeah, he's an amazing man and an amazing partner. And, you know, right before I met Brandon, I was single and I had just moved to Portland, Oregon. And I actually sat down, and I'd never really done this before, but I started to do some writing, actually, about what my ideal partner in life would be. And I don't mean like, you know, 6'2", brown hair, like not that kind of thing, but more their values and who they are as a person. And what I really came to is I want a partner who, when I'm with them, I feel like I'm becoming the best version of myself. I feel like my best qualities are amplified. I feel like I'm being pulled in the right direction, and vice versa, right? I can help them become the best version of themselves. And that's really simple, but it's really powerful, I think, because you know there are some people that you're with and you're just like, this is not, you know, you fight all the time. There's conflict constantly. You make each other feel worse, not better. You don't want that, right? You want the opposite.
Right.
So when I met Brandon, you know, I knew almost immediately, you know, I think this is that person for me. And over the last 40 years, we've both evolved so much. Brandon has gone from, you know, being a chef working in a restaurant to opening his own restaurant and running his own business with now eight employees under him, which has been a huge step forward. And I absolutely helped him to create that. I worked by his side. You know, I wanted him to become the best version of himself. And similarly for me, you know, he's been right by my side when I'm sobbing into my laptop because I have so many writing deadlines and I'm feeling, and he says to me, you know, you can do this, you can get through this. And he celebrates with me for my victories. And, you know, together we pull each other forward. So I think I very much learned what that means by watching my mom and dad and their amazing relationship over the years.
I think that's nice. All so very true, and I'm blessed to have a similar relationship. I remember that there was a time when I had a play done in L.A. and it had not gotten wonderfully reviewed, and I shortened it and was considering sending it to this very prestigious 10-minute play competition. And I'm thinking, why would I do that? It didn't get well reviewed. And my husband just looked at me and said, and Dale, you would relate to this, having said what you said, what have you got to lose? You know, what have you got to lose? Well,
right.
it ended up winning the top prize and getting published and really launched my career. So the point is, yes, you know, you need someone like that who picks you up when you're, you know, on the ground going, I can't, you know. And like both of you, I don't think I would have achieved half of what I have without him. And what's interesting is the other thing you were saying was about, and this brings two of the ideas we've been discussing together, was about this idea of, you know, there are times where their needs need to prevail and times where yours do. And for me, it was that my husband was an only child, and therefore I became his missing sibling. You know, when there were issues, health issues with his parents, I became that other person who could help him, who could aid him in taking care of them. And so during the time of raising our son and caring for both my parents and his parents, as many women have to do, the caretaking aspect of our lives is such a huge portion. So the way that I meant that related to something else you said was about women who get past, let's say, the age of 50. And often once you are in that position where your children are grown and your parents have perhaps passed away, and you're kind of looking at this sort of open-ended time, I like to call it the postmenopausal push. that women in that phase, in that postmenopausal phase, often take a new look at their lives. For me, it has been about working far harder than I ever did, because I had all those projects lined up that I desperately wanted to do, but many times they would take a back seat to these other responsibilities. And so now it's like, okay, I have to do them all now. I want to do them all. But my husband is, you know, knows that I go into my office and spend 10 hours a day there, and he's hugely supportive. So any rate, yes,
great.
I took long there to talk about that. But yes, the spouse is so, so important in a partnership. Is a true partnership is so important. One of the things that I wanted to ask about, Alex, is I have visited your wonderful website often, and what strikes me the most is how very wise you are for such a young woman. I'm just astounded, you know, that you have ways of giving little nuggets of advice that are just so spot on, and you also deal with, you use a lot of humor, but you also are very, very honest about yourself and your own struggles and where you've been. And I think, you know, and I advocate anyone who's listening to this today that you go and check out her website. You just have to Google Alexandra Friends and then you will find it. But one of the things that has struck me is how much of your work, both what you write and what you teach in your workshops and so forth, but also all the many things you put on your website are about inspiring others. So this desire to nurture and inspire others is also very much a Wren trait. When did you discover this desire within yourself, and describe some of the ways that you feel it manifests in your work?
Wow, that's a good question. You know,
well, I can tell you that she told us at like 8 or 9 years old that she wanted to have a column in the local newspaper called Allie's Corner, I think it was called. So we've always called her our mini Oprah.
I love that.
She always wanted to be in this world.
Yeah, I don't know where it came from or comes from exactly, but I mean, really, for as long as I can remember, I have loved personal stories. You know, I love reading memoirs. I love reading autobiographies. I love reading advice columns with stories, and I've always wanted to create my own. And I think that for whatever reason, it's like there's this pulse inside of me that's just like, whatever I experience in my life, whatever lessons I learn, the easy way or the hard way, I want to share them. I want to share what I've been through in the hopes that it might inspire or touch someone else, or maybe just even make someone else feel a little less alone in the world.
Yeah.
So I've always had that drive. And and I a really influential figure in my life, actually, is a guy named David Wagner, who is based in Minneapolis, where I used to live, and he was a hairstylist, a salon owner, and then later became instrumental in creating the brand Aveda, which is a brand that we all know and love. But when he was early on in his career as a hairstylist, he had this really profound experience where a woman came into the salon
And it was a regular customer. He knew her well. He had done her hair for many, many years. And she said, I want you to style my hair and make it look really nice. And he said, okay, great. You know, do you have a special event tonight or anything you're going to? And she said, no, nothing special. I just want my hair to look really nice. And he said, great. And he massaged her scalp and he, you know, spent a lovely hour with her and he made her laugh and feel, you know, welcome and loved. And he gave her a beautiful hairstyle and gave her a hug as she left. And then out the door she went. And a few days after that, David got a letter from this woman. And in the letter, she confessed that she had been planning to kill herself that night.
Oh, my.
And she wanted, she wanted her hair to look nice at her funeral. And that's why she had gone in. But she said in her letter, you know, because of the simple kindness that you showed to me in that hour and the way you made me feel, it gave me hope. And I decided to check myself into a hospital rather than going home. And she said in her letter to David, thank you for being there for me, even though you didn't know you were. And David tells this story. He wrote a book called Life as a Daymaker, and he tells this story in that book, which I read many years ago and I've never forgotten. And, you know, the message is so simple, right? It's the message of small acts of kindness, small acts of compassion, you know, a little moment of inspiration, whatever you can put forth into the world. You never know how it might touch another person's life, and it could make all the difference. It could be the difference between life and death. And that's something I've never forgotten. So I try to do that to whatever extent I can.
I think that's absolutely
wonderful.
Yeah,
very much.
I think that's my feeling so much at looking at your work. And talk briefly, we're starting to come towards the end, but I do want you to tell our listeners about this book that you have written, and it's called, looking for the title, tell me the title again.
It's called You're Going to Survive.
Yes, You're Going to Survive, which I love. So tell us briefly about what this book is and how people can find it.
Yeah, so You're Going to Survive is available for pre-orders now on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the usual places. And my publisher at the last moment actually moved the official release date to December 15th, so that's when it'll be in bookstores. But this book is a collection of true stories from my own career and from about 20 other people that I interviewed from all walks of life, all kinds of industries. And basically with each interview, I asked the people, can you tell me about one of the worst moments in your entire career? What happened? How did you feel? Mm-hmm. How did you get through it? And what did you learn from that experience? So it's stories about, you know, terrible reviews in the newspaper and online. It's stories about online bullying, about publicity scandals, about unhappy clients, about a boss who turned out to be a mafia kingpin. Like, I mean, you name it. There's so many stories in the book. And my motivations for writing it was really born from a very personal place, in that a couple of years ago, I began to realize, like, wow, you know, careers really do have ups and downs. And we all have moments where we just feel like, oh my God, could it get any worse? Like, can I move forward? Mm-hmm. Is this the end for me? We all have those moments. And I think we don't talk about them publicly. You know, we tend to talk about our victories and our achievements publicly, but we don't talk about our worst moments. And I wish we would, because we need reminders that everyone goes through those low points as well as those high points, and that we're going to make it. The book, I hope that someone will pick it up and keep it on their bedside table or their desk, and that they will crack open this book whenever they're having a rough day to get some inspiration and encouragement and a reminder that you're strong enough to get through whatever slump you're going through right now, whether it's big or small.
I love that. And with that, I need to say goodbye and to thank you both. We could have a whole other hour and still never tap everything. So I appreciate, and I'm signing out, and best of luck to both of you.
Thank you, Dale.
You've been listening to the Wren Women Salon podcast, inspired by the book Wren Women, what modern Renaissance women have to teach us about living rich, fulfilling lives. For more information, go to www.renwomen.com or www.renwomentalk.com. Ren Women is available for purchase on Amazon and can be ordered at a bookstore near you.